This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Intellectual History. My name is Tejas Parashar. I'm a research fellow in political thought at King's College, Cambridge. I'm joined today by Professor Tae-Yuan Kum, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Professor Kum is a political theorist broadly interested in ancient political thought and its reception in 20th century German social thought and in the intersection of political theory and literature. She received her PhD from the Department of Government at Harvard in 2017 and was previously the Christopher Tower Junior Research Fellow at Christ Church, Oxford. Her new book, which we'll be discussing today, is titled Plato and the Mythic Tradition in Political Thought. The book has recently been published by Harvard University Press, and it's a striking, beautifully written account of how Plato's theory of the role of myth in political life has been taken up by a range of European thinkers, from the early modern period down to the 20th century. The book takes us from Plato's own uses of myth in the Republic, to readings of Plato in the early modern writings of Thomas More and Francis Bacon, to 18th century German idealist philosophy, and then into the first half of the 20th century. Tae-Yuan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. So first of all, many congratulations on the book. And to start, could you just tell us a little bit about how you arrived at this project? Did you always intend to write about the modern reception of Greek philosophy?
No. And thank you for the question. Yeah, so like I went, this book came out of my PhD dissertation, and I did go into graduate school intending to write a dissertation just on Plato. And I think in the background, I think I had always been especially attracted to Plato's myths in particular. So Plato's myths are these vivid fantastical stories that Plato invented and integrated into his philosophical dialogues, so like the myth of metals and the Republic, or the eschatological myths at the end of the Phaedo, or the Gorgias and the Republic, so myths like that. But I think a moment that I've later come to look back on as a kind of aha moment that sparked the idea for the book was when I was sitting in a seminar taught by the great late Patrick Riley, and I came across a myth in a philosophical treatise written by Leibniz, a philosopher writing two millennia after Plato. So that's the Petite Fable at the end of the Theodicy, which ended up being the topic of the third chapter of my book. But briefly, the Petite Fable is this mythic dream vision about the coherence of the cosmos that concludes Leibniz's treatise on justice, the Theodicy, which is itself a title that Leibniz really went out of his way to Hellenize or kind of like Greekify, because it's Theos Dike, the justice of God. And that to me seemed like an obvious homage to Plato's myth of Ur, the mythic dream vision about the coherence of the cosmos that concludes Plato's Republic. And to some extent also to Scipio's dream, this mythic dream vision about the coherence of the cosmos that concludes Cicero's Republic. So this is when I started thinking that maybe Leibniz's myth was following in a distinct tradition. So that's when I started asking, well, who else was doing this? Who else was writing myths modeled after Plato's myths and sticking them in philosophical treatises? And why would a modern political philosopher even want to do that? So my book is, at the most basic level, a book about the legacy of Plato's myths in modern political thought. I just want to say, so that's the basic level. But there's also another level at which the book is also more broadly an inquiry into the place of myth in modern politics and philosophy. So post-truth politics really wasn't a thing when I started this project, but it very much was a thing by the time I was finishing it. And so I don't really define myth in terms of disinformation or things that are factually wrong, and this is something we can talk about later, but more recent shifts in culture and politics from the last several years have definitely helped impress upon me that myth is something that merits serious attention on the part of political theorists. So that was also something that was working in the background quite a bit later, in the later stages of writing this book.
Fascinating. So I wanted to just ask you a little bit about the figure at the center of the book, mm-hmm. Plato himself. So in a study of what you call the mythic tradition, is there a reason that you chose to focus on Plato and his legacy in particular? Is there anything distinctive about the Platonic approach to myth as opposed to, say, Homer or the epics?
Yeah, sure. I chose Plato because, Plato became important for my story because what I was trying to push back against was the certain canonical reputation that Plato has for being this kind of like founding figure for the entire Western intellectual tradition, and being that founding figure in a very a fairly narrow way, I think. So Plato at some point gained this reputation for having founded philosophy on kind of like rational grounds by divorcing it from the likes of myths. So in the formulation of this 20th century German classicist Wilhelm Nestle, Plato was at the center of this Greek revolution that turned the tide of philosophy so that it got set on this path that he called the path from mythos to logos, from myth to logic, I guess. And so that was what I was pushing back against, because I thought that reputation seemed very much in tension with the fact that Plato wrote these rich, beautiful myths. So I think that was the point of interest here. And I think what's quite distinctive about what Plato was doing was that he wasn't just taking existing myths and sort of like recasting them as sort of kind of like new literary stagings. He was inventing his own myths, and myths that were quite overtly philosophical insofar as they were kind of integrated into these larger philosophical works. So I thought Plato was doing something quite interesting, where he was appropriating the conventions of an existing literary genre and turning it into a completely new genre of philosophical myth writing.
And was the attention to this kind of genre of philosophical myth writing in Plato, did it always have to contend with the view of Plato as a rationalist philosopher?
Oh, yes, I love that question so much. So yes and no. So that reputation, that canonical reputation that I've just described of Plato being the sort of like champion of this kind of like progressive rational thinking that divorces itself from myth is the version that we've inherited is a relatively late construction in the reception of Plato. So that's very much an Enlightenment development, which I think is in itself a kind of like negotiation of a bunch of conflicting, warring accounts of the interpretation of Plato that made its way all the way down. So this is going to be a very crude history, but kind of like the two kind of like dominant traditions of interpreting Plato that are sort of in tension, that sort of get integrated into the Enlightenment account, is a tradition of skepticism. That really begins kind of like in the academy that Plato founded, but kind of like three generations after Plato's death, where the philosophers, these ancient Greek philosophers in the academy, started really emphasizing the skeptical spirit of Socratic investigation and saying that that is the essence of what Plato's philosophy was, and that that is Plato's project. So academic skeptics were quite invested in kind of like denying the coherence of Plato's philosophy. If you really push academic skepticism into a certain direction, then it the great virtue of that kind of philosophy is kind of like the disavowal of certain knowledge. So the theory of forms becomes quite inconvenient. So the dialogues that they like to read are kind of like the dialogues that portray Socrates in action, kind of like interrogating interlocutors, and then ending in this aporetic conclusions that say, oh, you have failed to tell me, Euthyphro, what piety is. I will never know. And that was kind of like the conclusion of philosophy. But then there's also this alternate, and so in that tradition, the myths would have been quite kind of like inconvenient and rather irrelevant things floating in there that didn't get emphasized. Whereas there is this other tradition, this like Neoplatonic tradition, as we would call it, that had these peaks in late antiquity and again in 14th century Italy, where the coherence of Plato's philosophy was something that did deserve a great deal of emphasis. So these were philosophers who and interpreters who really fixated on the theory of forms and fixated on kind of like the extreme unity of the theory of forms, almost to the extent that it became this kind of like mystical thing that emphasized the unity of, you know, the one or the form of the good that unites all the forms over which it presides. And there the myths do become important, but in a very specific vein where it's sort of like the vehicle by which divine inspiration comes to be transmitted through the medium of a divinely inspired poetic philosopher. So these are kind of like the two strands of Platonism kind of like working in the background until we get to the Enlightenment, where you get this reconciliation of the spirit of skeptical inquiry that becomes a kind of ideal for what critical reason should be in philosophy, but also this idea that get this idea that you can have a system of philosophy. You don't need to disavow knowledge, and you can get to something like the theory of forms through critical reason. Sorry, that was extremely long.
Fascinating stuff. So, I mean, that does lead to a question that I had, that the book itself has such a striking range of figures. We have Thomas More, Francis Bacon, Leibniz, who you mentioned earlier, Schlegel, and into the 20th century, people like Ernest Cassirer. As you're saying, what unites them is their insistence on the importance of mythological symbolism and belief in political life. But I am wondering how you decided which kinds of periods and authors you would focus on. Is it because they are all in conversation with the kind of Platonist tradition that you've just outlined for us?
Yeah, to some extent, yes. I think how I came upon these particular authors was sort of I think my process of eliminating people was a kind of like a Venn diagram of like, so like I needed authors who for whom Plato was very influential for their thought. To some extent, all the authors in the book are people who were reading and studying Plato very carefully, and in some instances actually imitating Plato. And I also wanted them to be people for whom myth was also important, especially in kind of like the overlap between these two spheres. So people for whom Platonic myth was especially important. And then the last Venn diagram component would be people whose philosophies or writings had some sort of like political consequence. So I did want this to be a story about the afterlife of Plato's myths and modern political thought in particular. So that was the process by which I came to these authors. To the extent that they were in conversation with kind of like Neoplatonism, to some extent. But what they were doing was actually quite, it might be a subtle difference, but quite different from what was going on in Neoplatonism. So to varying extents, these authors were sort of pushing back against the role that had been carved out for myth in the Neoplatonic tradition as a sort of medium that medium of inspiration that fills the gap between human knowledge and divine revelation, or revelation that sort of like emanates from this extreme, unknowable, overwhelmingly unified form of the good. And they had a kind of more down to earth and like more earthly approach to the to what myth was. So it wasn't this thing that was above human knowledge that filled some sort of gap. It was very much kind of like integrated with human efforts to to work out their understandings of the world.
Really interesting. And in, just in terms, so we have a sense of the kind of intellectual landscape here, and in terms of the distribution of these kinds of ideas in Enlightenment Europe and then later, is this beginning in Italy and Germany? Where are these kinds of ideas really concentrated?
Yeah, so it, my first post-Plato chapter is in early modern England, but after that, all my authors become German. As you point out, that is quite interesting. For better or for worse, Germany, especially around kind of like the Enlightenment, starts developing a very particular fixation with myth that doesn't quite appear as much in other intellectual traditions. Around the Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment is this big inflection point in the conceptualization of myth, where we get this story that myth is somehow opposed to philosophical reason and to philosophical progress, and philosophy would be a lot better off if we got rid of myth and all traces of myth in our heritage. And that's also the time when we get this this idea that Plato can be appropriated as a kind of figurehead for those very ideals. But Germany is where we see this the complication of that idea, especially as we enter this age of the German idealism, where people start taking issue with the legacy of the Enlightenment and wondering if these ideas had been pushed far enough. In German culture in particular, myth is not a thing that can be dismissed as mere nonsense, as had been the case in sort of like early Enlightenment treatments of myth. In the German intellectual tradition, myth is quite consistently a force that is has the potential to be immensely consequential and a part of the cultural fabric. This is why I think people who are thinking very seriously about the role of myth in politics and philosophy are also turning to Plato and Plato's myths for kind of guidance on how to work out some of these questions.
And how is that related to the more general preoccupation with ancient Greece in German intellectual circles?
Oh, yes, very much. So there's the this famous phrase that the tyranny of Greece over Germany, this idea that there was a point in the 18th century when Germany really turned to ancient Greek culture as a kind of ideal for a foil for both what they thought was kind of like lacking in their contemporary modern culture and as an ideal for what a kind of way of life that they wanted to reinvigorate in their own culture. And that's how kind of like the myths sort of get like imported into that discussion, because so much of what gets emphasized in the importation of kind of a Greek culture into German discourse is filtered through mythology, because this very much becomes like, okay, this is the central thing at the heart of Greek culture. You see mythology expressed in the art of Greek, in the ancient Greeks. You see it in the literature of ancient Greeks. And they really thought of mythology as this thing that got expressed in kind of like all spheres of life in ancient Greece. And that's how they started studying mythology as something that held the key to understanding the Greek way of life.
Mm. And I mean, one thing I'm struck by is you mentioned earlier that Cicero also drew on Plato's ideas of the myth and that stylized similar kinds of narratives. But it seems that Cicero was less important as a source for thinking about myth and political life than Plato himself. Is there a reason that Rome just kind of dropped out of the story?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Rome doesn't always drop out, but I think Rome is a lot less important to, the kind of like the Greek philosophers who do make it into my book. I think for the reasons that we've described, somehow it was ancient Greece that was the object of fixation for these authors.
And of course, that leads to one of the philosophers who plays a role in your book, which is Nietzsche and his account of Plato as a kind of rational philosopher in The Birth of Tragedy. Could you say a little bit about how Nietzsche is relating to this earlier tradition of thinking about Greek culture as a culture of myth?
Yeah, of course. So yeah, Nietzsche loved Greek culture, and he, I think, had very much, Nietzsche isn't always very good about, you know, like acknowledging sources of his, inspiration for him, but I think Nietzsche had very much inherited this German tradition of being very fascinated by Greek culture. And but for Nietzsche, Plato was the guy who came out and ruined everything. So Nietzsche's valorization of Greek culture in part also had to do with his admiration for the role of myth in Greek life. And Plato was the one who came around and overemphasized the Apollonian strand of culture at the expense of the more mythic, dark Dionysian strand. And I found Nietzsche very interesting that way, because in a way, even though Nietzsche is very critical of Plato and he sees him as the inaugurator of like philosophy, where it all goes wrong from there, Nietzsche does very much subscribe to this narrative about Plato that I'm very much trying to push back against, where Nietzsche does see Plato as this champion of this rationalized way of doing philosophy at the expense of myth, and who also sets the course for all of Western philosophy that comes after. So to Nietzsche, I would say, but look at Plato's myths. How would you interpret Plato's myths?
Right. And were there any intellectual circles in 19th century Germany, particularly, that did have the kind of mythic Plato in mind and took that more seriously?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and that's a big kind of gap in my book, because I sort of skip from the 18th century to the 20th century. But I think that's where we are sort of like living in kind of like the legacy of what the foundations that the German idealists and in particular the German romantics had planted in the culture. So those are the subjects of my 18th century chapter. So I think that's when these romantic ideals associated with what myth could do for politics really come to enter kind of like popular and more kind of like cultural spheres of thinking. So we were talking about Nietzsche, and we're sort of straying from Plato here, but Nietzsche is, of course, very enamored with and has like a very famous falling out with Wagner. But Wagner was someone who I think had inherited certain strands of German romanticism and thought very much that, okay, it is possible to create a new mythology for the German people. And the way I'm going to do that is to take Teutonic mythological traditions and try to reinvent them for the stage or for the operatic stage.
Right. I mean, and one thing that struck me in reading the chapters on German idealism and German romanticism in your book was also the place of literature, particularly and the literary as a whole in the story. So, for instance, you describe Schlegel's imagination of a, quote, genuinely poetic community for the modern era. So, we talked about Wagner and with Nietzsche, we can also talk about the Greek theater. But I wonder what role does a literary form like poetry in particular play within the mythical?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And at least I can sort of answer for the German idealists and then see where we go from there. These are the concepts of poetry and myth are just very closely intertwined for people like Schlegel. But they had a very particular understanding of poetry as not just kind of like, I don't know, like the road not taken, but poetry as a quintessentially creative act that has very much to do with kind of like the Greek word for poetry, poesis, which is a kind of creative making. For the German Romantics, poetry sort of like symbolized kind of like all creative activity. The problem that they were kind of contending with was the idea that somehow there was no creative spiritual freedom for individuals that made sense for them in like modern culture. And they thought that was somehow untrue to the true essence of what they called poetry, again, understood in this the broadest possible conception. They thought the essence of poetry was that poetry, art, etc., was that it like brought people together instead of kind of like individual poets isolated in society doing their own thing and not collaborating on anything that was unified. And this is where Greek mythology served. It just served as a source of inspiration for and as a kind of model for what they were thinking. So they're like, okay, so like Greek mythology occupies this super central place in Greek culture to the extent that it pervades all forms of art in Greek culture as they imagined it. And they thought that reviving that kind of role for mythology in modern culture could help remedy the situation where kind of like poets were creating individual works that didn't necessarily speak to each other or build on each other. So in the same way that individual Greek poets and tragedians would kind of contribute to the existing body of mythology that they had already inherited in ancient Greek culture, they thought that modern poets and artists and creative folk might be able to do the same if they had a new mythology that everyone was kind of drawing from and contributing to in turn.
So mythology and poetry as a kind of almost civic culture in many ways.
Yeah, very much, at least in that context, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly striking then that there is a preoccupation with Plato, given the kind of standard view of how Plato viewed poets and poetry in the Republic as a kind of potentially subversive, dangerous act, right?
Yeah, indeed. And Plato's banishment of the poets, I think, is very much tied to kind of like Plato's complicated relationship to myth in his period. So I think poetry back then was sort of like one of the default mediums through which a pre-existing mythological culture found expression. So, you know, you would have like, the myth of Icarus, for instance, and you might see this depicted in a particular Greek statue, but the way we kind of like know about it is also kind of like if like people wrote about Icarus and like put it on for the stage, people wrote epic poems about it. So things like that. So those are sort of like the genre differences that I think we were talking about. And Plato's condemnation of poetry very much is tied to his condemnation of Greek mythological culture as it stood in his time, because when Plato is sort of criticizing contemporary poetry, all the poetry that he's criticizing contains mythological material, because there really was not a lot of, or at the time he wasn't thinking of other kinds of poetry where they're kind of like making up stuff without references to mythology.
Yeah. And moving into the 20th century in our story, following you, chapter 4, could you say a little bit about how the Platonic theory of myth and the reinvention of the Platonic theory of myth, how it responded to the particular developments of the 20th century? I mean, as you note, mythology came to have a somewhat unsavory reputation in the 20th century. It came to be associated with excesses of nationalism, particularly of fascism. And we can see this in Karl Popper's critical remarks on myth, for instance, which you discuss. So how did someone like Ernest Cassirer, for instance, who's trying to think about Platonic myth, how was a figure like that responding to the ways myth was being understood in the 20th century?
Oh, yeah, great. Thank you so much. So as you mentioned, the 20th century becomes this huge inflection point for kind of like the history of people thinking about myth, because that's when Nazism happened. And up until then, I think all speculation on whether there can be mythology in modern politics and culture was quite speculative. And then the Nazis happened, and for everyone living through that period, somehow it just becomes like paradigmatically self-evident that when there is a resurgence of myth in modern culture, like Nazism and fascism is what it looks like. So that really ups the stakes for the place of myth and culture. And it just seems that, okay, if Nazism is what happens when people tolerate myth and culture, then maybe that's just too high a price to pay. And it really helps affirm the standard view that myth is something that is this regressive force that we should ideally be moving away from. The 20th century, for those reasons, becomes like this period where a lot of the themes that we've been kind of like talking about just really come to collide. So this is the theme of the place of myth in modern culture and politics, but also the idea of Plato as the founding figure of a coherent Western intellectual tradition that kind of like culminates in whatever philosophy is today. And the fact that Plato did write these myths into his philosophy, and these three themes seem like incompatible claims, the idea that Plato can be this rational figure who also wrote myths, but also it looks like myths are bad. So this is why I think we get, say, like people like Nietzsche having to take a side and ignore the myths and portray Plato as the inaugurator of a rational tradition that ended up somehow being bad for all of culture. And with the advent of Nazism, you get a Popper, who you just mentioned, taking a similar verdict on Plato, but for very different reasons. So Popper is noticing the myths and saying, like, actually, Plato is not the guy that we thought he was. He did inaugurate this entire Western tradition of thinking, but actually he put myth at the center in the first place. Popper has this famous line where he compares the myth of Ur, or the noble lie, to the Nazi myth of blood and soil. And he thinks Plato is the guy who planted these horrible and destructive mythic seeds into the stream of Western culture in the first place. These are the kind of tensions that people are trying to work out, they produce kind of like different results. And Kassir is also grappling with all these themes. So the idea that Plato is this founding figure, what do we do then with the Plato's legacy? Should it be a good thing or a bad thing? And where do the myths fit in? I think the chapter on Kassir sort of ends on a somewhat ambivalent note, because Kassir is someone who really wants to hold on to both the idea that Plato is a good guy, and that the legacy of Plato, the Western intellectual tradition, is something that is ultimately good and progressive and something worth saving instead of throwing out, like Popper suggests. And he also wants to hold on to this progressive vision of culture where we can, in fact, move beyond myths. But then he also finds Plato's myths extremely interesting and philosophically significant. And the way he sort of like goes about trying to triangulate these three themes is by making a bit of space, I think, in his philosophy of culture for acknowledging Plato's accomplishment as someone who is taking myth and turning it into a distinct philosophical genre, even where it seems sort of in tension with the larger ideals of what he thinks is philosophically desirable, and finding creative means of reworking philosophy kind of in unexpected places by reworking literary genres.
And in doing that, is Kassir ever reaching back to earlier interpreters of Plato in the 18th century or earlier?
Yeah, well, not that I can think of. My suspicion is that Kassir is getting... So, I mean, Kassir is, first of all, extremely well-read and, you know, is just this paradigmatic figure who was very, like, classically educated in he was like the embodiment of German building. He read everything and knew the tradition very well. I sense that he's getting a lot of his Plato from Werner Jaeger, but I'm not sure if I would necessarily die on that hill.
Right. And could you give us a sense of what happens to these two interpretations? I mean, does someone like Popper ever respond to the Kassir attempt to rehabilitate Plato in the mythic tradition? Are these two strands of interpretation ever in conversation with each other?
Yeah, that's great. So I am quite surprised that there was that Popper and Kassir haven't been brought together more often because they, to some extent, the Popper's verdict on Plato sort of represents this verdict that's sort of available to Kassir when he's trying to think through what he wants to do about, I don't know, like Plato's legacy and what he wants to do about Plato's, the fact of Plato's myths. And Popper represents a kind of like road not taken for Kassir, because I think Kassir is, for one reason or another, still very committed to liking Plato in a way that that Popper isn't.
Right. And one thing I'm curious about is whether the 18th century fixations on things like a civic culture, the role of poetry and mythology in cultivating a community, do those things become relevant for the 20th century attempt to rehabilitate Plato in the mythic tradition at all?
Yeah, so, I also didn't quite answer your last question. It's quite unclear how much take up there is of this tradition that I've sort of tried to reconstruct in my book. And at one level, Kassir's own star ends up fading because he very much becomes this sort of anachronistic philosopher whose vision of cultural progress starts looking quite Whiggish and outdated as the events, as people begin to reconcile with the events of the 20th century, and people start going for kind of like flashier philosophies that call for a more foundational overhaul of that inheritance and legacy. So to the extent that Kassir's philosophy doesn't really end up having a very outsized influence in kind of like what happens afterwards, we don't really hear much from say like Kassir's Plato either. Whereas kind of like Popper's interpretation of Plato does have a great deal of uptake, even though people don't really take Popper's actual reading of Plato seriously, they do very much start taking on board, especially as the events of the 20th century, the mid-20th century end up giving into the Cold War. People really start, Popper's idea of Plato as someone who wields myth against the ideals of an open society starts having a lot of uptake in the Cold War, and I think it even starts entering kind of like popular discourse. And I think these two Platos of kind of like Popper's Plato, who uses myth in this unsavory ways and uses myth against what he thinks are the ideals of philosophy and philosophically informed politics, sort of hovers alongside the Enlightenment Plato that I mentioned, of Plato, who is like a good guy who founded a coherent intellectual tradition of being anti-myth. And I think these two Platos have both made their way into our own popular interpretation of Plato. But now I've lost sight of your second question. Oh, about civic culture in 20th century. Again, not so much, because I think, I'm gonna have to think about this, but I guess what happens is in sort of the way that Kassir's Plato never really makes it, doesn't have the same amount of uptake, Plato also starts disappearing somewhat from discussions of myth in the latter half of the 20th century. So in the wake of Nazism, people continue to be quite interested in the relationship between myth and philosophy and politics up into kind of like the 80s or even early 90s. But Plato falls off. And I think this has at some level to do with people no longer doing that kind of like grand historical overview of the entire Western tradition that was kind of like popular at the beginning of the 20th century, and the very idea of like a coherent Western tradition rightly starts being more problematized and fragmented. And sorry, this is a very long-winded way of answering your question about civic culture, but I think that's where Plato's influence doesn't really make its way into those discussions.
Yeah, I mean, in reading your book, I was just struck by how the mythic Plato is never the Plato that we teach to undergraduates or even graduate students, really. I mean, it hasn't made its way into curricula.
Yeah, that's correct.
But the discussion of fascism does raise the larger point that we touched on briefly at the beginning, which is, what do we mean by myth exactly in the book, right? I mean, is there a distinction, meaningful distinction to be drawn between the kinds of narratives around which a kind of fascist politics might coalesce, or even conspiratorial thinking? and myth as we're understanding it through Plato.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. And I think this might not be a very satisfying answer, but I think I'm currently a bit agnostic about it. But it is the case that something that I found very weird throughout the process of writing this book is that myth is this like weirdly disproportionate concept. So it's like a concept that's taken on like a disproportionate amount of very fraught meanings when at the end of the day, it does seem to be this like very specific literary genre, but then it's also come to stand for kind of like all the things that we talk about today, like conspiratorial thinking, stuff at the bottom of like nationalism or like populist thinking. And I guess I also mentioned kind of like post-truth political culture. And I'm a bit agnostic on to what extent we can productively draw all of these kind of like scattered phenomena under the heading of myth. And that is just the conceptual history of how myth has evolved as the sort of like catch-all category for a whole bunch of forms of figurative thinking. At the same time, I think it is an interesting exercise to take that seriously. And I think when we take it seriously, what we see is that we get to have a renewed appreciation for the significant and consequential roles that these kind of like forms of thinking that we call myths seem to play in contemporary life. So it's no longer the case that we can kind of like pretend that these things are things that we somehow should have outgrown because we have outgrown traditional literary myths in the same way. And what Plato and his successors were doing was, I think, exploring that idea by reinventing a quite narrow and specific genre of philosophical myth and saying, can we use this limited genre to start exploring some of the more elusive phenomena underlying our thinking and culture that perhaps cannot be accessed quite as easily using kind of like the traditional toolkits of philosophy, but which might be reached and engaged with and maybe even reshaped through the writing of philosophical myths.
And you mentioned that the post-truth question was not directly on your mind when you began the project, but it became more and more salient. So could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So, and this is where I am sort of flailing a bit about, because I'm not really sure if I have definite positions on what I want to prescribe to people. But at one level, I think what people are beginning to recognize is that post-truth is... we talk about it as a kind of era of disinformation and people kind of like spewing facts that things that are not factually correct. And if we take seriously the kind of like rhetoric around some of these things as somehow mythical in some way. So when people talk about kind of like the myths that enter our political and cultural discourse in these particularly unsalient ways that these particularly unconstructive ways that are associated with post-truth politics, then we're not really concerned with facts that need to or claims that need to be factually debunked anymore. I think we should be digging a bit deeper into kind of like the figurative, imaginative, and the narrative things underlying these lies and pieces of disinformation. So it's the idea that there might be kind of like narrative or imaginative frameworks of meaning that are getting activated when we get certain pieces of disinformation. And what I think Plato and his successors in this tradition try to help us see is that it's not really enough to ignore the things that look like myths in our culture today, hoping that kind of like the mechanisms of rational progress will kind of like extinguish it and eventually. And it's also not enough to try to debunk each of these things using facts and arguments. But I think they think that we should be actively acknowledging the ways in which these frameworks, for better or for worse, do seem to be a source of meaning to the people who subscribe to them. We should be digging deeper down, and we should be trying to find more creative and potentially figurative means of engaging with them.
Perfect. And are you continuing to explore these themes in your new work? What are you interested in nowadays?
Yeah. So this was a book that explored some of these larger questions that that I've been trying to gesture at through the lens of Plato and his legacy. In my current work, I'm trying to move beyond that by dropping the Plato stuff and examining what these debates turn into kind of in the mid and late 20th century, especially in German philosophy. So I'm in particular looking at this German philosopher of myth, Hans Blumenberg, kind of in the context of his contemporary culture and trying to reconstruct what some of these debates around symbolic thinking were for their time.
Fantastic. I mean, that also speaks to so much, there's just so much interest in myth in the 20th century at the carried out by people who are somehow at the margins of our canon of political thought.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. In your book, I was also struck by the discussion of Freud, Jung. I mean, all these other people who are really so thinking so much about myth, but who, for some reason, we haven't taken those writings as reflections on politics very seriously.
Yeah, that's correct. So I think like a lot of there is a lot of theory out there, social theory out there that does take seriously the possibility that myth might be a more permanent fixture of our political reality than we might political theorists might want to acknowledge. But they do seem to come from traditions that are sort of political theory adjacent without being political theory itself. So like sociology, anthropology, bits of psychoanalysis, like you suggest.
Excellent. So, well, very much looking forward to your new project. And again, the book is fascinating. Thank you so much for joining me today, Taeyuan.
No, thank you so much for having me and for your really wonderful questions.